Forging and Industrial Society, 1865-1909. A nation of farmers fought the Civil War in the 1860s. By the time the Spanish-American War broke out in 1898, America was an industrial nation. For generations, Americans had plunged into the wilderness and plowed their fields. Now they settled in cities and toiled in factories. Between the Civil War and the century's end, economic and technological change came so swiftly and massively that it seemed to many Americans that a whole new civilization had emerged. In some ways it had. The sheer scale of the new industrial civilization was dazzling. Transcontinental railroads knit the country together from sea to sea. New industries like oil and steel grew to staggering size, and made mega-millionaires out of entrepreneurs like oilman John D. Rockefeller and steelmaker Andrew Carnegie. Drawn by the allure of industrial employment, Americans moved to the city. In 1860, only about 20% of the population were city dwellers. By 1900, that proportion doubled, as rural Americans and European immigrants alike flocked to Milltown and Metropolis in search of steady jobs. These sweeping changes challenged the spirit of individualism that Americans had celebrated since the 17th century. Even on the western frontier, that historic bastion of rugged loners, the hand of government was increasingly felt, as large armies were dispatched to subdue the Plains Indians and federal authority was invoked to regulate the use of natural resources. The rise of powerful monopolies called into question the government's traditional hands-off policy toward business, and a growing band of reformers increasingly clamored for government regulation of private enterprise. The mushrooming cities, with their need for transport systems, schools, hospitals, sanitation, and fire and police protection, required bigger government budgets than an earlier generation could have imagined. As never before, Americans struggled to adapt old ideals of private autonomy to the new realities of industrial civilization. With economic change came social and political turmoil. Labor violence brought bloodshed to places such as Chicago and Homestead, Pennsylvania. Small farmers, squeezed by debt and foreign competition, rallied behind the People's or Populist Party, a radical movement of the 1880s and 1890s that attacked the power of Wall Street, big business, and the banks. Anti-immigrant sentiment swelled. Bitter disputes over tariffs and monetary policy deeply divided the country, setting debtors against lenders, farmers against manufacturers, the West and South against the Northeast. And in this unfamiliar era of big money and expanding government, corruption flourished, from town hall to Congress, fueling loud cries for political reform. The bloodiest conflict of all pitted Plains Indians against the relentless push of westward expansion. As railroads drove their iron arrows through the heart of the West, the Indians lost their land and life-sustaining buffalo herds. By the 1890s, after 3 decades of fierce fighting with the U.S. Army, the Indians who had once roamed across the vast rolling prairies were struggling to preserve their shattered cultures within the confinement of reservations. The South remained the one region largely untouched by the Industrial Revolution sweeping the rest of America. A few sleepy southern hamlets did become boomtowns, but for the most part, the South's rural way of life and its peculiar system of race relations were largely unperturbed by the changes happening elsewhere. On African Americans, the vast majority of whom continued to live in the Old South, the post-emancipation era inflicted new forms of racial injustice. State legislatures systematically deprived Black Americans of their political rights, including the right to vote. Segregation of schools, housing, and all kinds of public facilities made a mockery of African Americans' Reconstruction-era hopes for equality before the law. The new wealth and power of industrial America nurtured a growing sense of national self-confidence. Literature flowered, and a golden age of philanthropy dawned. The reform spirit spread. So did a restless appetite for overseas expansion. In a brief war against Spain in 1898, the United States, born in a revolutionary war of independence and long the champion of colonial peoples yearning to breathe free, seized control of the Philippines and itself became an imperial power. Uncle Sam's venture into empire touched off a bitter national debate about America's role in the world and ushered in a long period of argument over the responsibilities, at home as well as abroad, of a modern industrial state. Political paralysis in the Gilded Age 1869-1896. Grant had no right to exist. He should have been extinct for ages. That 2,000 years after Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, a man like Grant should be called, and should actually and truly be, the highest product of the MOST. Advanced evolution made evolution ludicrous. The progress of evolution from President Washington to President Grant was alone evidence enough to upset Darwin. Grant should have lived in a cave and worn skins. Henry Adams, The Education of Henry Adams, 1907. The population of the post-Civil War Republic haunting ed to vault upward by vigorous leaps, despite the awful bloodletting in both Union and Confederate ranks. Census takers reported over 39 million people in 1870, a gain of 26.6% over the preceding decade, as the immigrant tide surged again. The United States was now the third largest nation in the Western world, ranking behind Russia and France. But the civic health of the United States did not keep pace with its physical growth. The Civil War and its aftermath spawned waste, extravagance, speculation, and graft. Disillusionment ran deep among idealistic Americans in the post-war era. They had spilled their blood for the Union, emancipation, and Abraham Lincoln, who had promised a new birth of freedom. Instead, they got a bitter dose of corruption and political stalemate, beginning with Ulysses S. Grant, a great soldier but an utterly inept politician. Wrangling between Congress and President Andrew Johnson had soured the people on professional politicians in the Reconstruction era, and the notion still prevailed that a good general would make a good president. Stubbly bearded General Grant was by far the most popular Northern hero to emerge from the war. Grateful citizens of Philadelphia, Washington, and his hometown of Galena, Illinois, passed the hat around and in each place presented him with a house. New Yorkers tendered him a check for $105,000. The general, silently puffing on his cigar, unapologetically accepted these gifts as his just deserts for having rescued the Union. Grant was a hapless greenhorn in the political arena. His one presidential vote had been cast for the Democratic ticket in 1856. A better judge of horse flesh than of humans, his cultural background was breathtakingly narrow. He once reportedly remarked that Venice, Italy would be a fine city if only it were drained. The Republicans, freed from the Union Party coalition of war days, enthusiastically nominated Grant for the presidency in 1868. The party's platform sounded a clarion call for continued reconstruction of the South under the glinting steel of federal bayonets. Yet Grant, always a man of few words, struck a highly popular note in his letter of acceptance when he said, "Let us have peace." This noble sentiment became a leading campaign slogan and was later engraved on his tomb beside the Hudson River. Expectant Democrats, meeting in their own nominating convention, denounced military reconstruction but could agree on little else. Wealthy Eastern delegates demanded a plank promising that federal war bonds be redeemed in gold, even though many of the bonds had been purchased with badly depreciated paper greenbacks. Poorer Midwestern delegates answered with the Ohio idea, which called for redemption in greenbacks. Dead-burdened agrarian Democrats thus hoped to keep more money in circulation and keep interest rates lower. This dispute introduced a bitter contest over monetary policy that continued to convulse the Republic until the century's end. Midwestern delegates got the platform but not the candidate. The nominee, former New York Governor Horatio Seymour, scuttled the Democrats' faint hope for success by repudiating the Ohio idea. Republicans whipped up enthusiasm for Grant by energetically waving the bloody shirt that is, reviving gory memo Rise of the Civil War, which became for the first time a prominent feature of a presidential campaign. "Vote as you shot" was a powerful Republican slogan aimed at Union Army veterans. Grant won, with 214 electoral votes to 84 Seymour. But despite his great popularity, the former general scored a majority of only 300,000 in the popular vote, 3,013,421 to 2,706,829. Most white voters apparently supported Seymour, and the ballots of three still unreconstructed southern states, Mississippi, Texas, and Virginia, were not counted at all. An estimated 500,000 former slaves gave Grant his margin of victory. To remain in power, the Republican Party somehow had to continue to control the South, and to keep the ballot in the hands of the grateful freedmen. Republicans could not take future victories for granted. A few skunks can pollute a large area. Although the great majority of business people and government officials continued to conduct their affairs with decency and honor, the whole post-war atmosphere was fetid. The man in the moon, it was said, had to hold his nose when passing over America. Freewheeling railroad promoters sometimes left gullible bond buyers with only two streaks of rust in a right of way. Unscrupulous stock market manipulators were a cinder in the public eye. Too many judges and legislators put their power up for hire. Cynics defined an honest politician as one who, when bought, would stay bought. Notorious in the financial world were two millionaire partners, Jubilee Jim Fisk and Jay Gould. The corpulent and unscrupulous Fisk provided the brass, while the undersized and cunning Gould provided the brains. The crafty pair concocted a plot in 1869 to corner the gold market. Their slippery game would work only if the Federal Treasury refrained from selling gold. The conspirators worked on President Grant directly and also through his brother-in-law, who received $25,000 for his complicity. On Black Friday, September 24, 1869, Fisk and Gould madly bid the price of gold skyward, while scores of honest business people were driven to the wall. The bubble finally broke when the Treasury, contrary to Grant's supposed assurances, was compelled to release gold. A congressional probe concluded that Grant had done nothing crooked, though he had acted stupidly and indiscreetly. The infamous Tweed Ring in New York City vividly displayed the ethics or lack of ethics typical of the age. Burly boss Tweed, 240 pounds of rascality, employed bribery, graft, and fraudulent elections to milk the metropolis of as much as $200 million. Honest citizens were cowed into silence. Protesters found their tax assessments raised. Tweed's luck finally ran out. The New York Times secured damning evidence in 1871 and courageously published it, though offered $5 million not to do so. Gifted cartoonist Thomas Nast pilloried Tweed mercilessly, after spurning a heavy bribe to desist. The portly thief reportedly complained that his illiterate followers could not help seeing them damn pictures. New York attorney Samuel J. Tobin headed the prosecution, gaining fame that later paved the path to his presidential nomination. Unbailed and unwept, Tweed died behind bars. More serious than boss Tweed's peccadilloes were the misdeeds of the federal government. President Grant's cabinet was a rodent's nest of grafters and incompetents. Favor seekers haunted the White House, plying Grant himself with cigars, wines, and horses. His election was a godsend to his in-laws of the Dent family, several dozen of whom attached themselves to the public payroll. The easygoing Grant was first tarred by the Credit Mobilier scandal, which erupted in 1872. Union Pacific Railroad insiders had formed the Credit Mobilier Construction Company and then cleverly hired themselves at inflated prices to build the railroad line, earning dividends as high as 348%. Fearing that Congress might blow the whistle, the company furtively distributed shares of its valuable stock to key congressmen. A newspaper exposé and congressional investigation of the scandal led to the formal censure of two congressmen and the revelation that the Vice President of the United States had accepted payments from Credit Mobilier. The breath of scandal in Washington also reeked of alcohol. In 1874-1875, the sprawling whiskey ring robbed the Treasury of millions in excise tax revenues. "Let no guilty man escape," declared President Grant. But when his own private secretary turned up among the culprits, he volunteered a written statement to the jury that helped exonerate the thief. Further rottenness in the Grant administration came to light in 1876, forcing Secretary of War William Belknap to resign after pocketing bribes from suppliers to the Indian reservations. Grant, ever loyal to his crooked cronies, accepted Belknap's resignation with great regret. By 1872, a powerful wave of disgust with Grantism was beginning to build up throughout the nation, even before some of the worst scandals had been exposed. Reform-minded citizens banded together to form the Liberal Republican Party. Voicing the slogan "Turn the Rascals Out," they urged purification of the Washington administration as well as an end to Melita Reconstruction. The Liberal Republicans muffed their chance when their Cincinnati nominating convention astounded the country by nominating the brilliant but erratic Horace Greeley for the presidency. Although Greeley was the fearless editor of the New York Tribune, he was dogmatic, emotional, petulant, and notoriously unsound in his political judgments. More astonishing still was the action of the office-hungry Democrats, who foolishly proceeded to endorse Greeley's candidacy. In swallowing Greeley, the Democrats ate crow in large gulps, for the eccentric editor had long blasted them as traitors, slave shippers, saloon keepers, horse thieves, and idiots. Yet Greeley pleased the Democrats, North and South, when he pleaded for clasping hands across the bloody chasm. The Republicans dutifully renominated Grant. The voters were thus presented with a choice between two candidates who had made their careers in fields other than politics and who were both eminently unqualified, by temperament and lifelong training, for high political office. In the mud-spattered campaign that followed, regular Republicans denounced Greeley as an atheist, a communist, a free lover, a vegetarian, a brown bread eater, and a co-signer of Jefferson Davis's bail bond. Democrats derided Grant as an ignoramus, a drunkard, and a swindler. But the regular Republicans, chanting "Grant us another term," pulled the president through. The count in the electoral column was 286-66, in the popular column 3,596,745-2,843,446. Liberal Republican agitation frightened the regular Republicans into cleaning their own house before they were thrown out of it. The Republican Congress in 1872 passed a General Amnesty Act, removing political disabilities from all but some 500 former Confederate leaders. Congress also moved to reduce high Civil War tariffs and to fumigate the Grant administration with mild civil service reform. Like many American third parties, the liberal Republicans left some enduring footprints, even in defeat. Grant's woes deepened in the paralyzing economic panic that broke in 1873. Bursting with startling rapidity, the crash was one of those periodic plummets that roller-coastered the economy in this age of unbridled capitalist expansion. Overreaching promoters had laid more railroad track, sunk more mines, erected more factories, and sowed more grain in fields than existing markets could bear. Bankers, in turn, had made too many imprudent loans to finance those enterprises. When profits failed to materialize, loans went unpaid, and the whole credit-based house of cards fluttered down. Boom times became gloom times as more than 15,000 businesses went bankrupt. In New York City, an army of unemployed riotously battled police. Black Americans were hard hit. The Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company had made unsecured loans to several companies that went under. Black depositors who had entrusted over $7 million to the bank lost their savings, and black economic development and black confidence in savings institutions went down with it. Hard times inflicted the worst punishment on debtors, who intensified their clamor for inflationary policies. Proponents of inflation breathed new life into the issue of greenbacks. During the war, $40 million of the folding money had been issued, but it had depreciated under a cloud of popular mistrust and dubious legality. By 1868, the Treasury had already withdrawn $100 million of the battle-borne currency from circulation, and hard-money people everywhere looked forward to its complete disappearance. But now afflicted agrarian and debtor groups' cheap money supporters clamored for a rise wants of the greenbacks. With a crude but essentially accurate grasp of monetary theory, they reasoned that more money meant cheaper money and, hence, rising prices and easier to pay debts. Creditors, of course, reasoning from the same premises, advocated precisely the opposite policy. They had no desire to see the money they had loaned repaid in depreciated dollars. They wanted deflation, not inflation. The hard money advocates carried the day. In 1874, they persuaded a confused Grant to veto a bill to print more paper money. They scored another victory in the Resumption Act of 1875, which pledged the government to the further withdrawal of greenbacks from circulation and to the redemption of all paper currency and gold at face value, beginning in 1879. Down but not out, debtors now looked for relief to another precious metal, silver. The sacred white metal, they claimed, had received a raw deal. In the early 1870s, the Treasury stubbornly and unrealistically maintained that an ounce of silver was worth only 1/16th as much as an ounce of gold, while open market prices for silver were higher. Silver miners thus stopped offering their shiny product for sale to the federal mints. With no silver flowing into the federal coffers, Congress formally dropped the coinage of silver dollars in 1873. Fate then played a sly joke when new silver discoveries later in the 1870s shot production up and forced silver prices down. Westerners from silver mining states joined with debtors in assailing the crime of 1873, demanding a return to the dollar of our daddies. Like the demand for more greenbacks, the demand for the coinage of more silver was nothing more nor less than another scheme to promote inflation. Hard money Republicans resisted the scheme and counted on Grant to hold the line against it. He did not disappoint them. The Treasury began to accumulate gold stocks against the appointed day for resumption of metallic money payments. Coupled with the reduction of greenbacks, this policy was called contraction. It had a noticeable deflationary effect. The amount of money per capita in circulation actually decreased between 1870 and 1880, from $19.42 to $19.37. Contraction probably worsened the impact of the Depression. But the new policy did restore the government's credit rating, and it brought the embattled greenbacks up to their full face value. When Redemption Day came in 1879, few greenback holders bothered to exchange the lighter and more convenient bills for gold. Republican hard money policy had a political backlash. It helped elect the Democratic House of Representatives in 1874, and in 1878 it spawned the Greenback Labor Party, which polled over a million votes and elected 14 members of Congress. The contest over monetary policy was far from over. The political seesaw was delicately balanced throughout most of the Gilded Age, a sarcastic name given to the three-decade-long post-Civil War era by Mark Twain in 1873. Even a slight nudge could tip the teeter-totter to the advantage of the opposition party. Every presidential election was a squeaker, and the majority party in the House of Representatives switched six times in the 11 sessions between 1869 and 1891. In only three sessions did the same party control the House, the Senate, and the White House. Wobbling in such shaky equilibrium, politicians tiptoed timidly, producing a political record that was often trivial and petty. Few significant economic issues separated the major parties. Democrats and Republicans saw very nearly eye to eye on questions like the tariff and civil service reform, and majorities in both parties substantially agreed even on the much-debated currency question. Yet despite their rough agreement on these national matters, the two parties were ferociously competitive with each other. They were tightly and efficiently organized, and they commanded fierce loyalty from their members. Voter turnouts reached heights unmatched before or since. Nearly 80% of eligible voters cast their ballots in presidential elections in the three decades after the Civil War. On election days, droves of the party faithful tramped behind marching bands to the polling places, and ticket splitting, or failing to vote the straight party line, was as rare as a silver dollar. How can this apparent paradox of political consensus and partisan fervor be explained? The answer lies in the sharp ethnic and cultural differences in the membership of the two parties, in distinctions of style and tone, and especially of religious sentiment. Republican voters tended to adhere to those creeds that traced their lineage to Puritanism. They stressed strict codes of personal morality and believed that government should play a role in regulating both the economic and the moral affairs of society. Democrats, among whom immigrant Lutherans and Roman Catholics figured heavily, were more likely to adhere to faiths that took a less stern view of human weakness. Their religions professed toleration of differences in an imperfect world, and they spurned government efforts to impose a single moral standard on the entire society. These differences in temperament and religious values often produced raucous political contests at the local level, where issues like prohibition and education loomed large. Democrats had a solid electoral base in the South and in the northern industrial cities, teeming with immigrants and controlled by well-oiled political machines. Republican strength lay largely in the Midwest and the rural and small-town Northeast. Grateful freedmen in the South continued to vote Republican in significant numbers. Another important block of Republican ballots came from the members of the Grand Army of the Republic, GAR, a politically potent fraternal organization of several hundred thousand Union veterans of the Civil War. The lifeblood of both parties was patronage, dispersing jobs by the bucketful in return for votes, kickbacks, and party service. boisterous infighting over patronage beset the Republican Party in the 1870s and 1880s. A stalwart faction, led by the handsome and imperious Lord Roscoe Conkling, U.S. Senator from New York, unblushingly embraced the time-honored system of swapping civil service jobs for votes. Opposed to the Conklingites were the so-called half-breeds, who flirted coyly with civil service reform, but whose real quarrel with the stalwarts was over who should grasp the ladle that dished out the spoils. The champion of the half-breeds was James G. Blaine of Maine, a radiantly personable congressman with an elastic conscience. But despite the color of their personalities, Conkling and Blaine succeeded only in stalemating each other and deadlocking their party. Hangers-on around Grant, like fleas urging their ailing dog to live, begged the old man to try for a third term in 1876. The general, blind to his own ineptitudes, showed a disquieting willingness. But the House, by a lopsided bipartisan vote of 233-18, derailed the third-term bandwagon. It passed a resolution that sternly reminded the country, and Grant, of the anti-dictator implications of the two-term tradition. With Grant out of the running and with the Conklingites and Blaineites neutralizing each other, the Republicans turned to a compromise candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, who was obscure enough to be dubbed the Great Unknown. His foremost qualification was the fact that he hailed from the electorally doubtful but potent state of Ohio, where he had served three terms as governor. So crucial were the swing votes of Ohio in the cliff-hanging presidential contests of the day that the state produced more than its share of presidential candidates. A political saying of the 1870s paraphrased Shakespeare, "Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some are born in Ohio." Pitted against the humdrum Hayes was the Democratic nominee, Samuel J. Tilden, who had risen to fame as the man who bagged Boss Tweed in New York. Campaigning against Republican scandal, Tilden racked up 184 electoral votes of the needed 185, with 20 votes in four states, three of them in the South, doubtful because of irregular returns. Surely Tilden could pick up at least one of these, especially in view of the fact that he had polled 247,448 more popular votes than Hayes, 4,284,020 to 4,036,572. Both parties scurried to send visiting statesmen to the contested southern states of Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida. All three disputed states submitted two sets of returns, one Democratic and one Republican. As the weeks drifted by, the paralysis tightened, generating a dramatic constitutional crisis. The Constitution merely specifies that the electoral returns from the states shall be sent to Congress, and in the presence of the House and Senate, they shall be opened by the President of the Senate. But who should count them? On this point the Constitution was silent. If counted by the President of the Senate or Republican, the Republican returns would be selected. If counted by the Speaker of the House or Democrat, the Democratic returns would be chosen. How could the impasse be resolved? Clash or compromise was the stark choice. The danger loomed that there would be no president on Inauguration Day, March 4, 1877. Tilden or Blood, cried Democratic hotheads, and some of their minutemen began to drill with arms. But behind the scenes, frantically laboring statesmen gradually hammered out an agreement in the Henry Clay tradition, the Compromise of 1877. The election deadlock itself was to be broken by the Electoral Count Act, which Congress passed early in 1877. It set up an electoral commission consisting of 15 men selected from the Senate, the House, and the Supreme Court. In February 1877, about a month before Inauguration Day, the Senate and House met together in an electric atmosphere to settle the dispute. The role of the states was told off alphabetically. When Florida was reached, the first of the three southern states with two sets of returns, the disputed documents were referred to the Electoral Commission, which sat in a nearby chamber. After prolonged discussion, the members agreed, by the partisan vote of 8 Republicans to 7 Democrats, to accept the Republican returns. Outraged Democrats in Congress, smelling defeat, undertook to launch a filibuster until hell froze over. Renewed deadlock was avoided by the rest of the complex compromise of 1877, already partially concluded behind closed doors. The Democrats reluctantly agreed that Hayes might take office in return for his withdrawing intimidating federal troops from the two states in which they remained, Louisiana and South Carolina. Among various concessions, the Republicans assured the Democrats a place at the presidential patronage trough and support for a bill subsidizing the Texas and Pacific Railroad's construction of a southern transcontinental line. Not all of these promises were kept in later years, including the Texas and Pacific subsidy. But the deal held together long enough to break the dangerous electoral standoff. The Democrats permitted Hayes to receive the remainder of the disputed returns, all by the partisan vote of 8-7. So close was the margin of safety, that the explosive issue was settled only 3 days before the new president was officially sworn into office. The nation breathed a collective sigh of relief. The compromise bought peace at a price. Violence was averted by sacrificing the black freedmen in the South. With the Hayes-Tilden deal, the Republican Party quietly abandoned its commitment to racial equality. That commitment had been weakening in any case. The Civil Rights Act of 1875 was, in a sense, the last feeble gasp of the congressional radical Republicans. The act supposedly guaranteed equal accommodations in public places and prohibited racial discrimination in jury selection, but the law was born toothless and stayed that way for nearly a century. The Supreme Court pronounced much of the act unconstitutional in the civil rights cases. The court declared that the 14th Amendment prohibited only government violations of civil rights, not the denial of civil rights by individuals. Hayes clinched the bargain by withdrawing the last federal troops that were propping up carpetbag governments. The bayonet-backed Republican regimes collapsed as the blue-clad soldiers departed. The Democratic South speedily solidified and swiftly suppressed the now friendless blacks. Reconstruction, for better or worse, was officially ended. Shamelessly relying on fraud and intimidation, white Democrats' redeemers resumed political power in the South and exercised it ruthlessly. Blacks who tried to assert their rights faced unemployment, eviction, and physical harm. Blacks as well as poor whites were forced into sharecropping and tenant farming. Former slaves often found themselves at the mercy of former masters who were now their landlords and creditors. Through the crop lien system, storekeepers extended credit to small farmers for food and supplies and in return took a lien on their harvests. Shrewd merchants manipulated the system so that farmers remained perpetually in debt to them. For generations to come, Southern blacks were condemned to eke out a threadbare living under conditions scarcely better than slavery. With white Southerners back in the political saddle, daily discrimination against blacks grew increasingly oppressive. What had started as the informal separation of blacks and whites in the immediate post-war years developed by the 1890s into systematic state-level legal codes of segregation known as Jim Crow laws. Southern states also enacted literacy requirements, voter registration laws, and poll taxes to ensure full-scale disfranchisement of the South's black population. The Supreme Court validated the South's segregationist social order in the case of Plessy v. Ferguson. It ruled that separate but equal facilities were constitutional under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But in reality, the quality of African American life was grotesquely unequal to that of whites. Segregated in inferior schools and separated from whites in virtually all public facilities, including railroad cars, theaters, and even restrooms, blacks were assaulted daily by galling reminders of their second-class citizenship. To ensure the stability of this political and economic new order, Southern whites dealt harshly with any black who dared to violate the South's racial code of conduct. A record number of blacks were lynched during the 1890s, most often for the crime of asserting themselves as equals. It would take a second Reconstruction, nearly a century later, to redress the racist imbalance of Southern society. The year 1877 marked more than the end of Reconstruction. As the curtains officially closed on regional warfare, they opened on scenes of class warfare. The explosive atmosphere was largely a byproduct of the long years of depression and deflation following the Panic of 1873. Railroad workers faced particularly hard times. When the presidents of the nation's four largest railroads collectively decided in 1877 to cut employees' wages by 10%, the workers struck back. President Hayes's decision to call in federal troops to quell the unrest brought the striking laborers an outpouring of working-class support. Work stoppages spread like wildfire in cities from Baltimore to St. Louis. When the battling between workers and soldiers ended after several weeks, over 100 people were dead. The failure of the Great Railroad Strike exposed the weakness of the labor movement. Racial and ethnic fissures among workers everywhere fractured labor unity and were particularly acute between the Irish and the Chinese in California. By 1880, the Golden State counted 75,000 Asian newcomers, about 9% of its entire population. Mostly poor, uneducated, single males, they derived predominantly from the Taishan district of Kuantiyuanji, Guangdong province in southern China. They had originally come to America to dig in the goldfields and to sledgehammer the tracks of the transcontinental railroads across the West. When the gold supply petered out and the tracks were laid, many, perhaps half of those who arrived before the 1880s, returned home to China with their meager savings. Those who remained in America faced extraordinary hardships. They worked at the most menial jobs, often as cooks, laundrymen, or domestic servants. Without women or families, they were marooned in a land where they neither were wanted nor wanted to be. They lived lonely lives, bereft of the children who in other immigrant communities eased their parents' assimilation through their exposure to the English language and American customs in school. The phrase "not a Chinaman's chance" emerged in this era to describe the daunting odds against which they struggled. In San Francisco, Irish-born demagogue Dennis Kearney incited his followers to violent abuse of the hapless Chinese. The Kearneyites, many of whom were recently arrived immigrants from Europe, hotly resented the competition of cheap labor from the still more recently arrived Chinese. The beef eater, they claimed, had no chance against the rice eater in a life and death struggle for jobs and wages. The present tens of thousands of Chinese coolies were regarded as a menace, the prospective millions as a calamity. Taking to the streets, gangs of Kearneyites terrorized the Chinese by shearing off their precious pigtails. Some victims were murdered outright. Congress finally slammed the door on Chinese immigrant laborers when it passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, prohibiting all further immigration from China. The door stayed shut until 1943. Some exclusionists even tried to strip native-born Chinese Americans of their citizenship. But the Supreme Court ruled in U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark in 1898 that the 14th Amendment guaranteed citizenship to all persons born in the United States. This doctrine of birthright citizenship, or jus soli, the right of the soil, as contrasted with jus sanguinis, the right of blood tie, which based citizenship on the parent's nationality, provided important protections to Chinese Americans as well as to other immigrant communities. As the presidential campaign of 1880 approached, Rutherford Hayes was a man without a party, denounced and repudiated by the Republican Old Guard. The Republican Party sought a new standard bearer for 1880 and finally settled on a dark horse candidate, James A. Garfield, from the electorally powerful state of Ohio. His vice presidential running mate was a notorious stalwart henchman, Chester A. Arthur of New York. Energetically waving the bloody shirt, Garfield barely squeaked out a victory over the Democratic candidate and Civil War hero, Winfield Scott Hancock. He polled only 39,213 more votes than Hancock, 4,453,295 to 4,414,082, but his margin in the electoral column was a comfortable 214 to 155. The new president was energetic and able, but he was immediately ensnared in a political conflict between his Secretary of State, James G. Blaine, and Blaine's stalwart nemesis, Senator Roscoe Conkling. Then, as the Republican factions dueled, tragedy struck. A disappointed and mentally deranged office seeker, Charles J. Guiteau, shot President Garfield in the back in a Washington railroad station. Garfield lingered in agony for 11 weeks and died on September 19, 1881. Guiteau, when seized, reportedly cried, "I am a stalwart. Arthur is now President of the United States." The implication was that now the Conklingites would all get good jobs. Guiteau's attorneys argued that he was not guilty because of his incapacity to distinguish right from wrong, an early instance of the insanity defense. The defendant himself demonstrated his weak grip on reality when he asked all those who had benefited politically by the assassination to contribute to his defense fund. These tactics availed little. Gitta was found guilty of murder and hanged. Garfield's death had one positive outcome: it shocked politicians into reforming the shameful spoils system. The unlikely instrument of reform was Chester Arthur. Observers at first underestimated him. His record of cronyism and his fondness for fine wines and elegant clothing, including 80 pairs of trousers, suggested that he was little more than a foppish dandy. But Arthur surprised his critics by prosecuting several fraud cases and giving his former stalwart pals the cold shoulder. Disgust with Garfield's murder gave the Republican Party itself a previously undetected taste for reform. The medicine finally applied to the long-suffering federal government was the Pendleton Act of 1883, the so-called Magna Carta of civil service reform. It made compulsory campaign contributions from federal employees illegal, and it established the Civil Service Commission to make appointments to federal jobs on the basis of competitive examinations rather than pool. Although at first covering only about 10% of federal jobs, civil service reform did rein in the most blatant abuses. Yet like many well-intentioned reforms, it bred unintended problems of its own. With the plum federal posts now beyond their reach, politicians were forced to look elsewhere for money, the mother's milk of politics. Increasingly, they turned to the bulging coffers of the big corporations. A new breed of boss emerged, less skilled at mobilizing small armies of immigrants and other voters on election day, but more adept at milking dollars from manufacturers and lobbyists. The Pendleton Act partially divorced politics from patronage, but it helped drive politicians into marriages of convenience with big business leaders. President Arthur's surprising display of integrity offended too many powerful Republicans. His ungrateful party turned him out to pasture, and in 1886 he died of a cerebral hemorrhage. James G. Blaine's persistence in pursuit of his party's presidential nomination finally paid off in 1884. The dashing Maine politician, blessed with almost every political asset except a reputation for honesty, was the clear choice of the Republican convention in Chicago. But many reform-minded Republicans gagged on Blaine's candidacy. Blaine's enemies publicized the fishy-smelling Mulligan letters, written by Blaine to a Boston businessman and linking the powerful politician to a corrupt deal involving federal favors to a southern railroad. At least one of the damning documents ended with a furtive warning: burn this letter. Some reformers, unable to swallow Blaine, bolted to the Democrats. They were sneeringly dubbed mugwumps, a word of Indian derivation meant to suggest that they were sanctimonious or holier than thou. Victory-starved Democrats turned enthusiastically to a noted reformer, Grover Cleveland. A burly bachelor with a soup-straining mustache and a taste for chewing tobacco, Cleveland was a solid but not brilliant lawyer of 47. He had rocketed from the mayor's office in Buffalo to the governorship of New York and the presidential nomination in 3 short years. Known as Grover the Good, he enjoyed a well-deserved reputation for probity in office. But Cleveland's admirers soon got a shock. Resolute Republicans, digging for dirt in the past of Bachelor Cleveland, unearthed the report that he had been involved in an amorous affair with a Buffalo widow. She had an illegitimate son, now 8 years old, for whom Cleveland had made financial provision. Democratic elders were demoralized. They hurried to Cleveland and urged him to lie like a gentleman, but their ruggedly honest candidate insisted, "Tell the truth." The campaign of 1884 sank to perhaps the lowest level in American experience, as the two parties grunted and shoved for the hog trough of office. Few fundamental differences separated them. Even the bloody shirt had faded to a pale pink. "Personalities, not principles," claimed the headlines. Crowds of Democrats surged through city streets, chanting, to the rhythm of "left, left, left, right, left, burn, burn, burn this letter." Republicans taunted in return, "Ma, ma, where's my pa?" Defiant Democrats shouted back, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." The contest hinged on the state of New York, where Blaine blundered badly in the closing days of the campaign. A witless Republican clergyman damned the Democrats in a speech as the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion, insulting with one swift stroke the culture, the faith, and the patriotism of New York's numerous Irish-American voters. Blaine was present at the time but lacked the presence of mind to repudiate the statement immediately. The pungent phrase, "short into RRR," stung and stuck. Blaine's silence seemed to give assent, and the wavering Irishman who deserted his camp helped account for Cleveland's paper-thin plurality of about 1,000 votes in New York State, enough to give him the presidency. Cleveland swept the solid South and squeaked into office with 219 to 182 electoral votes and 4,879,507 to 4,850,293 popular votes. Bullneck Cleveland in 1885 was the first Democrat to take the oath of presidential office since Buchanan, 28 years earlier. Huge question marks hung over his ample frame, 5 feet 11 inches, 250 pounds. Could the party of disunion be trusted to govern the Union? Would desperate Democrats, ravenously hungry after 24 years of exile, trample the frail sprouts of civil service reform in a stampede to the patronage trough? Could Cleveland restore a measure of respect and power to the maligned and enfeebled presidency? Cleveland was a man of principles, most of them safely orthodox by the standards of his day. A staunch apostle of the hands-off creed of laissez-faire, the new president caused the hearts of business people and bankers to throb with contentment. He summed up his political philosophy in 1887 when he vetoed a bill to provide seeds for drought-ravaged Texas farmers. Though the people support the government, he declared, the government should not support the people. As tactless as a mirror and as direct as a bulldozer, he was outspoken, unbending, and profanely hot-tempered. At the outset, Cleveland narrowed the North-South chasm by naming to his cabinet two former Confederates. As for the civil service, Cleveland was whipsawed between the demands of the Democratic faithful for jobs and the demands of the mugwumps, who had helped elect him, for reform. Believing in the merit system, Cleveland at first favored the cause of the reformers, but he eventually caved into the carpings of Democratic bosses and fired almost two-thirds of the 120,000 federal employees, including 40,000 incumbent Republican postmasters, to make room for deserving Democrats. Military pensions gave Cleveland some of his most painful political headaches. The politically powerful Grand Army of the Republic GAR routinely lobbied hundreds of private pension bills through a compliant Congress. Benefits were granted to deserters, to bounty jumpers, to men who never served, and to former soldiers who in later years had incurred disabilities in no way connected with war service. A Democrat and a non-veteran, Cleveland was in an awkward position when it came to fighting the pension grabbers. But the conscience-driven president read each bill carefully, vetoed several hundred of them, and then laboriously penned individual veto messages for Congress. Cleveland also risked his political neck by prodding the hornet's nest of the tariff issue. During the Civil War, tariff schedules had been jacked up to new high levels, partly to raise revenues for the insatiable military machine. American industry, which was preponderantly in Republican hands, had profited from this protection and hated to see the sheltering benefits reduced in peacetime. But the high duties continued to pile up revenue at the customs houses, and by 1881 the Treasury was running an annual surplus amounting to an embarrassing $145 million. Most of the government's income, in those pre-income tax days, came from the tariff. Congress could reduce the vexatious surplus in two ways. One was to squander it on pensions and pork barrel bills and thus curry favor with veterans and other self-seeking groups. The other was to lower the tariff, something the big industrialist vehemently opposed. Grover Cleveland, the rustic Buffalo attorney, had known little and cared less about the tariff before entering the White House. But as he studied the subject, he was much impressed by the arguments for downward revision of the tariff schedules. Lower barriers would mean lower prices for consumers and less protection for monopolies. Most important, they would mean an end to the Treasury surplus, a standing mockery of Cleveland's professed belief in fiscal orthodoxy and small government frugality. After much hesitation, Cleveland saw his duty and overdid it. With his characteristic bluntness, Cleveland tossed an appeal for lower tariffs like a bombshell into the lap of Congress in late 1887. The response was electric. Cleveland succeeded admirably in smoking the issue out into the open. Democrats were deeply depressed at the obstinacy of their chief. Republicans rejoiced at his apparent recklessness. The old warrior Blaine gloated, "There's one more president for us in tariff protection for the first time in years, A real issue divided the two parties as the 1888 presidential election loomed. Dismayed Democrats, seeing no alternative, somewhat dejectedly nominated Grover Cleveland in their St. Louis convention. Eager Republicans turned to Benjamin Harrison, whose grandfather was former President William Henry Tippecanoe Harrison. The tariff was the prime issue. The two parties flooded the country with some 10 million pamphlets on the subject. The specter of a lowered tariff spurred the Republicans to frantic action. In an impressive demonstration of the post-Pendleton Act politics of alliances with big business, they raised a war chest of some $3 million, the heftiest yet, largely by frying the fat out of nerve house industrialists. The money was widely used to line up corrupt voting cattle known as repeaters and floaters. In Indiana, always a crucial swing state, votes were shamelessly purchased for as much as $20 each. On election day, Harrison nosed out Cleveland, 233 to 168 electoral votes. A change of about 7,000 ballots in New York would have reversed the outcome. Cleveland actually polled more popular votes, 5,537,857 to 5,447,129, but he nevertheless became the first sitting president to be voted out of his chair since Martin Van Buren in 1840. After a four-year famine, the Republicans under Harrison licked their lips hungrily for the bounty of federal offices. They yearned to lavish upon the party faithful the fat surpluses produced by the high tariffs. But in the House of Representatives, they had only three more votes than the necessary quorum of 163 members, and the Democrats were preparing to obstruct all House business by refusing to answer roll calls, demanding roll calls to determine the presence of a quorum, and employing other delaying tactics. Into this tense cockpit stepped the new Republican Speaker of the House, Thomas B. Reed of Maine. A hulking figure who towered 6'3", he was renowned as a master debater. He spoke with a harsh nasal drawl and wielded a verbal harpoon of sarcasm. To one congressman who quoted Henry Clay that he would rather be right than be president, Reed caustically retorted that he would never be either. Opponents cringed at the crack of his quip. Reed soon bent the intimidated House to his imperious will. He counted as present Democrats who had not answered the roll and who, rulebook in hand, furiously denied that they were legally there. By such tactics, R. Reed utterly dominated the billion-dollar Congress, the first in history to appropriate that sum. Congress showered pensions on Civil War veterans and increased government purchases of silver. To keep the revenues flowing in, and to protect Republican industrialists from foreign competition, the billion-dollar Congress also passed the McKinley Tariff Act of 1890. Boosting rates to their highest peacetime level ever, an average of 48.4% on douchable goods. Sponsored in the House by rising Republican star William McKinley of Ohio, the new Tariff Act brought fresh woes to farmers. Debt-burdened farmers had no choice but to buy manufactured goods from high-priced protected American industrialists, but were compelled to sell their own agricultural products into highly competitive, unprotected world markets. Mounting discontent against the McKinley tariff caused many rural voters to rise in wrath. In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republicans lost their precarious majority and were reduced to just 88 seats, as compared with 23 Democrats. Even the much-touted McKinley went down to defeat. Ominously for conservatives, the new Congress also included 9 members of the Farmers Alliance, a militant organization of southern and western farmers. Politics was no longer as usual in 1892, when the newly formed People's Party, or Populists, burst upon the scene. Rooted in the Farmers' Alliance of frustrated farmers in the great agricultural belts of the West and South, the Populists met in Omaha and adopted a scorching platform that denounced the prolific womb of governmental injustice. They demanded inflation through free and unlimited coinage of silver at the rate of 16 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold. They further called for a graduated income tax, government ownership of the railroads, telegraph, and telephone, the direct election of U.S. senators, a one-term limit on the presidency, the adoption of the initiative and referendum to allow citizens to shape legislation more directly, a shorter workday, an immigration restriction. As their presidential candidate, the populists uproariously nominated the eloquent old Greenbacker, General James B. Weaver. An epidemic of nationwide strikes in the summer of 1892 raised the prospect that the populace could weld together a coalition of aggrieved workers and indebted farmers in a revolutionary joint assault on the capitalist order. At Andrew Carnegie's Homestead Steel plant near Pittsburgh, company officials called in 300 armed Pinkerton detectives in July to crush a strike by steelworkers angry over pay cuts. Defiant strikers, armed with rifles and dynamite, forced their assailants to surrender after a vicious battle that left 10 people dead and some 60 wounded. Troops were eventually summoned, and both the strike and the union were broken. That same month, federal troops bloodily smashed a strike among silver miners in Idaho's fabled Coeur d'Alene district. The populace made a remarkable showing in the 1892 presidential election. Saying goodbye, party bosses, they rolled up 1,029,846 popular votes and 22 electoral votes for General Weaver. They thus became one of the few third parties in U.S. history to break into the electoral column. But they fell far short of an electoral majority. Industrial laborers, especially in the urban East, did not rally to the populist banner in appreciable numbers. Populist electoral votes came from only 6 Midwestern and Western states, 4 of which Kansas, Colorado, Idaho, and Nevada fell completely into the populist basket. The South, although a hotbed of agrarian agitation, proved especially unwilling to throw in its lot with the new party. Race was the reason. The more than 1 million Southern black farmers organized in the Colored Farmers National Alliance shared a host of complaints with poor white farmers, and for a time their common economic goals promised to overcome their racial differences. Recognizing the crucial edge that black votes could give them in the South, populist leaders like George's Tom Watson reached out to the black community. Watson was a wiry redhead who could talk like the thrust of a bowie knife. He declared, "There is no reason why the black man should not understand that the law that hurts me, as a farmer, hurts him, as a farmer." Many blacks were disillusioned enough with the Republican Party to respond. Alarmed, the conservative white bourbon elite in the South played semi-galley upon historic racial antagonisms to counter the populist's appeal for interracial solidarity and woo back poor whites. Southern blacks were heavy losers. The populist-inspired reminder of potential black political strength led to the near-total extinction of what little African-American suffrage remained in the South. White Southerners more aggressively than ever used literacy tests and poll taxes to deny blacks the ballot. The notorious grandfather clause exempted from those requirements anyone whose forebear had voted in 1860 when, of course, black slaves had not voted at all. More than half a century would pass before Southern blacks could again vote in considerable numbers. Accompanying this disfranchisement were more severe Jim Crow laws, designed to enforce racial segregation in public places, including hotels and restaurants, and backed up by atrocious lynchings and other forms of intimidation. The conservative crusade to eliminate the black vote also had dire consequences for the populist party itself. Even Tom Watson abandoned his interracial appeals and, in time, became a vociferous racist himself. After 1896, the populist party lapsed increasingly into vile racism and staunchly advocated black disfranchisement. Such were the bitterly ironic fruits of the populist campaign in the South. With the populists divided and the Republicans discredited, Grover Cleveland took office once again in 1893, the only president ever re-elected after defeat. He was the same old bull-necked and bull-headed Cleveland, with a little more weight, polish, conservatism, and self-assertiveness. But though it was the same old Cleveland, it was not the same old country. Debtors were up in arms, workers were restless, and the advance shadows of panic were falling. Hardly had Cleveland seated himself in the presidential chair when the devastating depression of 1893 burst about his burly frame. Lasting for about 4 years, it was the most punishing economic downturn of the 19th century. Contributing causes were the splurge of overbuilding and speculation, labor disorders, and the ongoing agricultural depression. Free silver agitation had also damaged American credit abroad, and the usual pinch on American finances had come when European banking houses began to call in loans from the United States. Distress ran deep and far. About 8,000 American businesses collapsed in 6 months. Dozens of railroad lines went into the hands of receivers. Soup kitchens fed the unemployed, while gangs of hobos tramps wandered aimlessly about the country. Local charities did their feeble best, but the federal government, bound by the let nature take its course philosophy of the times, saw no legitimate way to relieve the suffering masses. Cleveland, who had earlier been bothered by a surplus, was now burdened with a deepening deficit. The Treasury was required to issue legal tender notes for the silver bullion that it bought. Owners of the paper currency would then present it for gold, and by law the notes had to be reissued. New holders would repeat the process, thus draining away precious gold in an endless chain operation. Alarmingly, the gold reserve in the Treasury dropped below $100 million, which was popularly regarded as the safe minimum for supporting about $350 million in outstanding paper money. Cleveland saw no alternative but to halt the bleeding away of gold by engineering a repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act of 1890. For this purpose, he summoned Congress into an extra session in the summer of 1893. Unknown to the country, complications threatened from another quarter. A malignant growth had developed on the roof of Cleveland's mouth, and it had to be removed on a private yacht with extreme secrecy. If the president had died under the surgeon's knife, his place would have been taken by the soft money vice president, Adlai E. Stevenson, an eventuality that would have deepened the crisis. In Congress, the debate over the repeal of the Silver Act was meanwhile running its heated course. A silver-tongued young Democratic congressman from Nebraska, 33-year-old William Jennings Bryan, held the gallery spellbound for 3 hours as he championed the cause of free silver. The Friends of Silver announced that hell would freeze over before Congress would pass the repeal measure. But an angered Cleveland used his job-granting power to break the filibuster in the Senate. He thus alienated the Democratic silverites like Bryan and disrupted his party at the very outset of his administration. Repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act only partially stopped the hemorrhaging of gold from the Trias Suri. In February 1894, the gold reserve sank to a dismaying $41 million. The United States was now in grave danger of going off the gold standard, a move that would render the nation's currency volatile and unreliable as a measure of value and that would also mortally cripple America's international trade. Cleveland floated 2 Treasury bond issues in 1894, totaling over $100 million, but the endless chain operations continued relentlessly. Early in 1895, Cleveland turned in desperation to J.P. Morgan, the banker's banker and the head of Wall Street Syndicate. After tense negotiations at the White House, the bankers agreed to lend the government $65 million in gold. They were obviously in business for profit, so they charged a commission amounting to about $7 million. But they did make a significant concession when they agreed to obtain one half of the gold bond and take the necessary steps to dam it up in the leaky treasury. The loan, at least temporarily, helped restore confidence in the nation's finances. The bond deal stirred up a storm. The Wall Street ogre, especially in the eyes of the silverites and other debtors, symbolized all that was wicked and grasping in American politics. President Cleveland's secretive dealings with the mighty Jupiter Morgan were savagely condemned as a sellout of the national government. But Cleveland was certain that he had done no wrong. Sarcastically denying that he was Morgan's errand boy, Cleveland asserted, "Without shame and without repentance, I confess my share of the guilt." Cleveland suffered further embarrassment with the passage of the Wilson-Gorman Tariff in 1894. The Democrats had pledged to lower tariffs, but by the time their tariff bill made it through Congress, it had been so loaded with special interest protection that it made scarcely a dent in the high McKinley tariff rates. An outraged Cleveland grudgingly allowed the bill, which also contained a 2% tax on incomes over $4,000, to become law without his signature. When the Supreme Court struck down the income tax provision in 1895, the populace and other disaffected groups found proof that the courts were only the tools of the plutocrats. Democratic political fortunes naturally suffered in the face of these several setbacks. The tariff dynamite that had blasted the Republicans out of the House in 1890 now dislodged the Democrats, with a strong helping hand from the Depression. The revitalized Republicans, singing "Times Are Mighty Hard," won the congressional elections of 1894 inches a landslide, 244 seats to 105 for the Democrats. The Republicans began to look forward to the presidential race of 1896 with unconcealed glee. Despite his gruff integrity and occasional courage, Grover Cleveland failed utterly to cope with the serious economic crisis that befell the country in 1893. He was tied down in office by the same threads that held all the politicians of the day to Lilliputian levels. Grant, Hayes, Garfield, Arthur, Harrison, and Cleveland are often referred to as the forgettable presidents. Bewhiskered and bland in person, they left mostly blanks, or blots, on the nation's political record, as issues like the tariff, the money question, and the rights of labor continued to fester. What little political vitality existed in Gilded Age America was to be found in local settings or in Congress, which overshadowed the White House for most of this period. But before the century ended, down-and-out debtors and disgruntled workers would make one last titanic effort to wring reform out of the political system, in the momentous election of 1896. Varying viewpoints. The populists, radicals or reactionaries? Taking their cue from contemporary satirical commentaries like Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner's The Gilded Age, the first historians who wrote about the post-Civil War era judged it harshly. They condemned its politicians as petty and corrupt, limited the emergence of a new plutocratic class, and railed against the arrogance of corporate power. Such a view is conspicuous in Charles and Mary Beard's The Rise of American Civilization, perhaps the most influential American history textbook ever written. It is equally evident in Vernon Lewis Parenton's classic literary history, Main Currents of American Thought, in which the entire post-Civil War period is contemptuously dismissed as a time of the Great Barbecue. The Beards and Parenton were leaders of the so-called progressive school of historical writing that flourished in the early years of the 20th century. Progressive historians, many of whom grew up in the Gilded Age, shared in the widespread disillusionment that the Civil War had failed to generate a rebirth of American idealism. Their political sympathies were chillingly anti-business and warmly pro-labor, pro-farmer, and pro-reform. Historians of the progressive persuasion identified populism as virtually the only organized opposition to the social, economic, and political order that took shape in the last decades of the 19th century. The populists thus became heroes to several generations of writers who bemoaned that order and looked back longingly at America's agrarian past. John D. Hicks, The Populist Revolt, is the classic portrayal of the populists as embattled farmers hurling defiance at Wall Street and the robber barons in a last-ditch defense of their simple, honest way of life. Bowed but unbroken by the defeat of their great champion, William Jennings Bryan, in the presidential election of 1896, the populists, Hicks claimed, left a reforming legacy that flourished again in the progressive era and the New Deal. Hicks's point of view was the dominant one until the 1950s, when it was sharply criticized by Richard Hofstadter in The Age of Reform. Hofstadter charged that the progressive historians had romanticized the populists, who were best understood not as picturesque protesters, but as harassed little country businessmen bristling with provincial prejudices. The city-born and bred Hofstadter argued that the populist revolt was aimed not just at big business and the money power but also somewhat irrationally at urbanism, immigrants, the East, and modernity itself. Hofstadter thus exposed a dark side of populism, which contained elements of backwoods anti-intellectualism, paranoia, and even anti-Semitism. In the 1960s, several scholars, inspired by the work of C. Van Woodward, as well as by sympathy with the protest movements of that turbulent decade, began to rehabilitate the populists as authentic reformers with genuine grievances. Especially notable in this vein was Lawrence Goodwin's Democratic Promise, The Populist Movement in America. Goodwin depicted the populists as reasonable radicals who were justifiably resentful of their eclipse by urban industrialism and finance capitalism. He also portrayed populism as the last gasp of popular political participation, a democratic moment in American history that expired with the populist absorption into the Democratic Party. Two subsequent works, Edward L. Ayers's Promise of the New South and Robert C. McMath's American Populism, synthesized many of the older perspectives and presented a balanced view of the populists as radical in many ways but also limited by their nostalgia for a lost agrarian past. The Chinese. In the late 19th century, the burgeoning industries and booming frontier towns of the United States Pacific Coast hungered for laborers to wrench minerals from stubborn rock, to lay down railroad track through untamed wastelands, and to transform dry expanses into fertile fields of fruit and vegetables. In faraway Asia, the Chinese answered the call, contributing their muscle to the building of the West. They dug in the gold mines and helped to lay the transcontinental railroads that stitched together the American nation. The first Chinese had arrived in Spanish America as early as 1565. But few followed those earliest pioneers until the 1848 discovery of gold in California attracted people from all over the world to America's Pacific coast. Among them were many fortune-hungry Chinese who sailed into San Francisco, which Chinese immigrants named the Golden Mountain. A treaty negotiated with China in 1868 by the American diplomat Anson Burlingame guarantees important civil rights to Chinese immigrants. The California boom coincided with the culmination of years of tumult and suffering in China. The once great Chinese empire was disintegrating, while a few ruthless landlords, like looters, grabbed control of nearly every acre of farmland. In destructive complement to this internal disarray, the European imperial powers forced their way into the unstable country, seeking to unlock the riches of a nation that had been closed to outsiders for centuries. Faced with economic hardship and political turmoil, more than 2 million Chinese left their homeland between 1840 and 1900, for destinations as diverse as Southeast Asia, Peru, Hawaii, and Cuba, with more than 300,000 entering the United States. Although their numbers included a few merchants and artisans, most were unskilled country folk. In some cases, families pooled their money to send out a son, but most travelers, desperately poor, obtained their passage through Chinese middlemen, who advanced them ship fare in return for the emigrants' promise to work off their debts after they landed. This contracting sometimes led to conditions so cruel that the practice was ignominiously called pig selling. The Chinese America of the late 19th century West was overwhelmingly a bachelor society. Women of good repute rarely made the passage. Of the very few Chinese women who ventured to California at this time, most became prostitutes. Many of them had been deceived by the false promise of honest jobs. Although a stream of workers returned to their homeland, many Chinese stayed. Chinatowns sprang up wherever economic opportunities presented themselves, in railroad towns, farming villages, and cities. Chinese in these settlements spoke their own language, enjoyed the fellowship of their own compatriots, and sought safety from prejudice and violence, never rare in American society. Many immigrant clubs, American adaptations of Chinese traditions of loyalty to clan or region, were established in these communities. Rivaling such clubs and associations were the secret societies known as tongs. The word tong, literally, meeting hall, acquired a sinister reputation among non-Chinese, for the tongs counted the poorest and shabbiest immigrants among their members. These were people without ties to a clan, those individuals most alienated from traditional Chinese organizations and from American society as well. Mounting anti-Chinese agitation forced the repudiation of the Burlingame Treaty in 1880, and in 1882 the Chinese Exclusion Act barred nearly all Chinese from the United States for 6 decades. Many of the bachelors who had made the long journey to America died or returned home. Slowly, however, those men and the few women who remained raised families and reared a new generation of Chinese Americans. But the second generation still suffered from discrimination, eking out their living in jobs despised by Caucasian laborers or taking daunting risks in small entrepreneurial ventures. Yet many hard-working Chinese did manage to open their own restaurants, laundries, and other small businesses. The enterprises formed a solid economic foundation for their small community and remain a source of livelihood for many Chinese Americans even today.